Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn, and you are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Monday, the 4th of October. You're enjoying Wisconsin Public Radio without a pledge drive today, thanks to the more than 800 listeners, ain't that something, who stepped up to support our programs and our Take Days Off campaign. We're trying to make tomorrow pledge-free, too, which would be wonderful. We need about 156 pledges. Is that right, Rhonda?
I think 163 of them.
Oh, 163, okay, before this day is over, and which we ought to be able to do. So go to WPR.org and get another day off this baby, and we can talk for a full hour tomorrow. Donna Brazile is going to be joining us momentarily for our All Things Political show. In the meantime, we thought we would tell you once again about our librarian who's coming to town, Nancy Pearl. We consider her our librarian, in a wonderful event at the Milwaukee Art Museum coming up pretty soon.
That's right, October 21st, Kathleen, at the Art Museum, downtown Milwaukee. From 9 to 11, we'll be broadcasting live. Lori Winters, the curator of exhibits for the museum, will also be joining us. And we just kind of want to get a count of how many people we're expecting, so you can either email me at fanning@wpr.org, or if you're a fan of the show on Facebook, there should be a message in your inbox, and you can just hit I plan to attend or I don't plan to attend for the RSVP. If you're not already a fan of the Kathleen Dunn Show on Facebook, you can go to Facebook, look for the Kathleen Dunn Show, become a fan, and then on the left-hand side, scroll down, it'll say events, upcoming events, and it'll say one event. Live remote from the museum. You can click on that and RSVP that way.
Okay.
That way we can just kind of get a number of how many people we're expecting. We're probably up to about 50 right now. So
good.
Yeah.
It's going to be a great day. I love that place. It is so beautiful. Did you notice over the weekend American Idol had their callback auditions in that room, you know, the Calatrava
uh-huh.
room?
Which, I did not notice that.
Yeah, there's a picture in the paper of the judges who called back. A lot of people from Milwaukee, I guess. They think we're a talented bunch here in this city.
I guess so.
Yeah. So it's October
21st.
21st.
9 to 11. People get there short before 9, take their seats before the show starts. And then afterwards, we're going to have a little reception in that wonderful Calatrava that you had just mentioned.
So we're going to have food and coffee.
And drinks and, yeah, snacks. And
snacks and wonderful
yeah.
day. Wonderful
pastries
day.
And coffee. You can't beat it.
And we're talking about books and art.
Yes.
What more can you
at
ask
at the museum.
For? At the museum, the most beautiful place in Milwaukee.
That's true.
It sounds good. All right, October 21st. Thank
I'll
you, Rhonda.
See you there. Uh-huh.
We'll see you later. Rhonda Fanning, producer of this program, along with Chrissy Pease, who will soon be getting Donna Brazile for us as we go to All Things Political. Let me introduce Donna Brazile, although she, you know who she is. She's a veteran Democratic political strategist, adjunct professor, author, syndicated columnist, television political commentator, vice chair of voter registration and participation at the Democratic National Committee, and former chair of the DNC's Voting Rights Institute. She is a native of New Orleans, and she has a passion for encouraging young people to vote. We may start with that issue, the first question, to work within the system to strengthen it and to also run for public office. She served as campaign manager for former Vice President Al Gore, becoming the first African-American woman to manage a presidential campaign. She is the author of Cooking with Grease, Stirring the Pots in American Politics. In 2009, the Oprah magazine chose Ms. Brazile as one of its 20 remarkable visionaries for the magazine's first ever O Power list, and she was named among the 100 most powerful women by Washingtonian magazine, top 50 women in America by Essence magazine, and received the Congressional Black Caucus Foundation's highest award for political achievement. We have a lot to talk about this hour, as we always do, as we get closer and closer to the midterm elections. We will look at the strategies that the Democrats are using, the Republicans are using, the youth vote. We'll talk about that. Rahm Emanuel has left the White House. We'll talk about his departure and what change that might mean for the White House. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. And if you would like to send us an email, you are very welcome to do that. The email is talk@wpr.org. Talk@wpr.org. Hello, Donna Brazile.
Good morning.
Nice to have you with us today.
Thank you, ma'am. ma'am.
Let's start with Obama's visit to Madison to endorse Democratic candidates here in Wisconsin last week. It was a very large rally. The purpose, of course, to attract the younger vote. Was it successful? Did you think he would have that many people show up for the rally?
Oh, absolutely. Look, President Obama remains personally popular across the country. While his poll numbers have dipped over the last 19 months of governing, young people still look up to President Obama as a symbol of hope, of transformation, as an inspiring political figure. And I do believe that in the closing weeks of this very volatile and unpredictable election season, you'll see young people once again gather the strength to go back out to the polls and make a difference in this election cycle.
Mm-hmm. The Times had a piece yesterday, Republicans carry substantial advantages, but the resilience of vulnerable Democrats is complicating Republican efforts to lock down enough votes to capture the House and take control of the Senate. What's your assessment about a month away from the elections, Donna? Is it more fluid?
Oh, yes, it is. Two things. First of all, everyone continues to compare this cycle to 1994. There's huge differences. There's differences in the economy. There's differences in terms of voter participation. We have more independent voters today than we had back in 1994. And for Democrats who had the majority in 1994, I believe they didn't see the tidal wave coming. They've known for a while that the tsunami was possible, and therefore they protected themselves. We held down the number of retirees. We made sure that Democrats in those so-called red districts had resources. We ran good candidates in open seats. And so I think with the exception of outraising Republicans and money, because they have more sources of money than the Democrats, the Democrats are prepared for a vigorous fight, a vigorous debate, and hopefully they can retain the majority in both the House and the Senate. I'm biased, of course, because I'm a Democrat. But more importantly, I'm an American who cares about the future of our country, and I believe Democrats have offered the country a path forward to economic growth and prosperity in the future. And they've utilized their time on Capitol Hill and elsewhere to help strengthen the middle class, to save our economy from the brink. And hopefully with the changes made in the health care law, the environmental laws, and, of course, Wall Street reform, we will see some changes in the years to come.
Let's talk a little more about jobs. As you well know, the unemployment rate is so high in this country. The Democrats were not able to get it together to get a tax thing fixed in terms of having the very wealthy among us pay more for their income taxes. And people really need jobs. Can you fault the administration? Can you fault the Democrats for not really dealing with what the number one issue is for many Americans? And that's work.
There's no question as I take a sip of coffee.
That's fine. It's early.
look, you know, they say hindsight is 20/20. I think the administration, and if I fault the administration, it's simply when they walked into the White House, the president should have ordered someone to scrub the books. I mean, scrub everything. Go down to the basement floor and figure out exactly how deep and wide the recession was. Because I think what happened was is that the Democrats offered a stimulus plan that got at part of the problem, but not the entire problem. Part of the problem was that state and local governments were also hemorrhaging money. Revenues are down. Unemployment was at 8%. The administration sought to put a big Band-Aid on a problem that probably needed, you know, to have surgery, to put more funds and resources. Yes, it's taxpayers' money, but there was no other option at the time but to try to save our banks, save our economy, and to utilize whatever federal resources we had to attack some of the structural problems that would have caused even more trouble had the administration not stepped in. So could they have done better? Yes. But the fact is that they put every ounce of energy into trying to forge a compromise with the Republicans on money that would go to help state and local governments, tax relief to American taxpayers through the form of tax cuts. I mean, my employees, I own a small business, they received a tax cut. Their taxes were lowered. And, of course, you know, making critical investment in our infrastructure across the country to try to save or at least help save certain industries so that the economy would not tank. So I believe that they put a yeoman's effort into it. But you know what bothered me at that time and what continues to bother me is that no one held the banks and others accountable. Yes, they're returning some of the money that they borrow. The auto industry is returning some of the money that was borrowed. But at the end of the day, I really believe that we should have put more pressure on those industries. The administration should have scrubbed a little bit deeper, and we should have gotten the private sector on board early enough. Now, the administration is reaching out to the private sector. There's a public private partnership job program, that a job training program that they will be announcing today. But I still give the administration a B minus maybe. I give the Republicans an absolute F for failing to show up to help fix some of the problems they created. Now, that's not a partisan view. It is a Washington, D.C. view, because, as you know, there's parts of this city that's broken. I'm not talking about the beautiful neighborhoods. I'm talking about the institution. Congress just can't figure out how to get along. I don't see why we elect people to Congress who the only thing they want to come here is grandstand and shout and close down the government. If they don't want to be part of the solution, then keep them back in the districts where they belong. Let them work it out locally, but don't come to Washington, D.C. and create gridlock and more confusion and more chaos.
I think a lot of people agree with you, Donna, but how do you break that?
We stop electing people who are not interested in helping solve problems. I'm a Democrat, but 5 years ago when Hurricane Katrina made landfall on my beloved home state in the city where I was born, I sat down with the Bush administration. I didn't sit down because I was a Democrat. I sat down because I was an American who believed that you got to work together in times of crisis. There's a time to campaign, and there's a time to work together. And the Republicans have failed to understand that. They've been measuring drapes from the moment President Obama took office. Measuring drapes. I mean, Rush Limbaugh, Glenn Beck, Sarah Palin today are the three leading figures of the Republican Party. And what's their message? We want President Obama to fail. When President Obama fails, then we all fail. The country fails. So we can have differences of approach on health care. We can have differences of approach on the environment or even the economy. But we should understand that when we're in a crisis, we come together. And that's the problem I have today with modern politics. People don't understand that when you're in a crisis, you come together. When my family's in a crisis, and God knows we have more varieties in my family than they have at Ben and Jerry's. But we come together. We come together to solve problems. And that's a failure of American political system today. We have more people who are interested in scoring points and people that should be elected, leaders, people who can fill the vacuum, who can inspire hope and change and work out our differences. Those people, we are purging moderates from our political system, and that's a mistake on both the left as well as the right.
What do you think about these Tea Party candidates who are getting a whole huge measure of ink from all of the newspapers in the country, the races that have Tea Party members? What do they do for the Democrats? What do they do for the political system? Do they stand any chance of winning? Are the Republicans worried about them, or do they need to embrace them?
Well, first of all, the Tea Party and Republican Party is one thing. There's no difference. The Tea Party movement came as a result of the election of 2008. Now, I understand there were many Americans who were frustrated with the Republicans and Democrats prior to 2008, but let me just say this. We start seeing more coverage, more vitriol from a very small minority of the population in the aftermath of the 2008 election than we saw in the aftermath of the 2000, 2002, 2004, 2006 elections. So what happened was this group of Americans believed that the president's policies were, you know, basically anti-American. They began to call the president of the United States a socialist, a communist. Then they start saying he was an other, he was not born in America. We have spent so much time trying to dispute the lies of the Tea Party movement. Not all Tea Party members are like this, but there's a very certain strand of Tea Party members that have really poisoned the political well with their vitriol, with their lies, with their biases. I get emails all the time just from ordinary people who write me and said, They don't say, I disagree with you, Miss Brazil. Can we have an exchange of views? They say, you're a liar. You're standing up for that Kenyan. And I'm like, he's not a Kenyan. He's an American. His daddy was born in Kenya. He was born on American soil. And so no matter how much you try to dispute their lies, they still paint you as somehow a puppet of the president that they don't believe is legitimately, qualified to hold the office of president of the United States. So the media has given the Tea Party more airtime, more ink than I've ever seen in any movement. But let me just say this. They have provided energy. They have provided organization. They have engaged the Republicans. They are responsible for reviving the Republican Party. Now, the problem with the Tea Party is that when you ask 60% of them, who's your leader, they have no leader. Well, how would you go about solving the problems? They really haven't come up with anything other than this doctrine of less government, smaller taxes. Well, you know, we all wish we can go back to the 1950s or the 1940s or the 1920s. The problem is we live in a 21st century economy. We have to compete on the global marketplace in order for America to be competitive. And yet the Tea Party, when you ask them if they were willing to work with President Obama, they said no. So there's a reason why the media should focus on Christine O'Donnell, Sharon Angle, Rand Paul, Mr. Buck, all these other so-called Tea Party leaders and candidates across the country. But we should expose them. We should expose their views. We know where Russ Feingold stands. We need to know where Mr. Johnson, in the case of your state, Wisconsin. We need to know their views. I want to know what Ms. O'Donnell plans to do about Social Security. Will she privatize it? We know where that'll go. But I really do hope we need to have an earnest debate, not another one of those 30-second cable shout fests, to find out more about the Tea Party and their ideas on governing in America in the 21st century.
We're seeing a whole lot of ads from groups we're not familiar with in Wisconsin and throughout the country, and you write about this today, the new world of campaign finance, as you call it, that the Supreme Court has ushered in. You mentioned the American Action Network, Americans for Prosperity, American Crossroads. Who are these groups? And the Times had an interesting piece yesterday about somebody who is trying to find who the people were behind campaign against health care reform, and it took them to all kinds of places. It took them to an insurance company eventually. But who are these organizations, and how much money are they pouring into campaigns?
They are pouring in record numbers, a record amount of money. I mean, it is this year. The advertising for House and Senate races has soared to $220 million. It's probably up to $250 million this week in terms of the ad buy. They are front groups for pharmaceutical companies, for health insurance companies, for big Wall Street finances, hedge fund managers, and others who really want to, you know, buy what they can't win at the ballot box. So they are pouring in record amount of money to confuse voters, to track them and divide them. You know, I have to digress for one moment. In the aftermath of the 2008 presidential season, it was a historic season. We, for the first time in our history, we saw, you know, a qualified woman compete for the presidency. And not to say that Shirley Chisholm and Pat Schroeder and Elizabeth Dole and others were not qualified, but Hillary Clinton was a very viable candidate who could have won the Democratic nomination and ultimately become president of the United States. We saw Barack Obama come pretty much from nowhere to win the Democratic nomination. And on the Republican side, you know, we met Governor Sarah Palin, former governor. You know, she's now a former governor. But it was a historic season. The American people were engaged. They followed a debate. They were very much involved in the political process. And then something happened. We elected our first black president. And let me just tell you, as an African American, I believe all hell has broken loose. There are people across this country now that are just, you know, making charges against the president, against what's going on in the country. It's somehow or another, you know, what we did in 2008. When I say we, the majority of American people, President Obama didn't win with the black vote. He won with the American vote. He had the support of every major category of voters in this country. But these individuals now are hell-bent on reversing what we did in 2008. So they are pouring, they are emotionally invested in pouring millions of dollars of money. And yes, Karl Rove, a person that I know very well, Ed Gillespie, who I was on yesterday against on CNN, and many others, They're basically the strategists behind this money going into these races. And we will probably never know unless Congress or someone pass a law. So these front groups, these so-called 501c4, they're using this bogus tax status to get the money. Unless they disclose their donors, we will never know what interest group is behind it. But I tell you what they want to do. They want to reverse the changes, the laws, the policies that have been put in place to help the poor and the middle class and other Americans revive this economy. They want to reverse any laws that will hurt their so-called profit margin. They are more worried about their quarterly profit margin than they are worried about the health of the American economy and the health of the middle class. So I think we need to expose them. We need to educate the American people that when they hear American Crossroads, American Future Fund, Americans for Prosperity, when they hear these so-called names, they should alarm should go off in their head, like, who are these people?
Donna Brazile is our guest this hour for All Things Political, and we're welcoming phone calls. We have one line open, so grab it, 800-486-8655. Our email address is talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. The number is 800-486-8655. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. During this time of money being hard to come by and hard to plan for your retirement, Connie Kilmark will be joining us to talk about all kinds of things related to your financial life. We do want to tell you that Julian Zelizar is going to be with us tomorrow. Jimmy Carter, we're happy to hear, is out of the hospital and doing fine and back at bookstores selling his book. Julian, professor of history and political science, public affairs rather, at Princeton University, has a new book. Jimmy Carter is the name of it. So he's with us tomorrow at 10 o'clock. Two phone calls for Donna Brazile, and let's start with Sarah from Zion, Illinois. Hi, Sarah.
Hi, good morning. Ms. Brazile, I can't tell you what a privilege it is for me to be able to talk to you today.
Thank you, ma'am.
And, what's been on my mind is exactly what you're talking about the exaggerated media coverage of the Tea Party. And because based on some polls I've read about, it seems like popular support for the Tea Party has been way exaggerated, and that more people support Obama's policies than the media is reporting very much. And I just happened to see the video off Fox last week, which was just really terrifying. And I wonder if other media outlets are following Fox News' lead like they have done on other issues.
You know, thank you for your question. As a cable call girl, I call myself that sometime, Kathleen, because I'm on CNN. I get so turned off by the coverage myself. We oversimplify an issue, or sometimes we're never able to explain it. And of course, every day we are driven to discuss polls. Now, as a former campaign manager and a woman who's worked on more campaigns than I care to admit, I understand the importance of polls. The polls are a strategic tool in a campaign, but the way in which the media use poll and information is to exaggerate the influence of one group of voters when we haven't had an election. Rather than use the poll to say, you know, if you look at this poll, there are 15% of people undecided. Now, who are those 15%, and what makes them undecided? We look at the number of people who claim to be Democratic or Republican. We constantly focus on the partisan, so our focus is always on the vision. And politics should be about what we normally say, addition, multiplication, how you add people, how you bring people into the process. It shouldn't be about how you divide people, how you subtract. And so the media needs to do some self-correction. But right now, because Fox is the leader in the news business, I often believe that the narrative is drawn from Fox. So Fox News, which has Newt Gingrich on the payroll, Sarah Palin on the payroll, Karl Rove on the payroll, and many others, Mike Huckabee, I can continue to name a bunch of others, and Fox News Corporation, which has donated money to the Republican Party and the Republican Governors Association. Fox News is in the business now of electing Republicans. based on not only their analysts, but their coverage. Now, CNN has Carville, Gala, Brazil. I don't think anyone else. I'm pounding my brain. We also have Mary Matlin, Alex Castellano. So we have both Republican as well as Democratic contributors. So we're often balanced against each other so that one side will not dominate the conversation. But Fox, the narrative that Fox News drops each and every day is ultimately the narrative that we often go with, and which means that we're always dealing with a negative situation. It's never positive. It's never good. It's never about the American people. And God forbid if it's ever about what is in a piece of legislation that will help average people. We can't talk about it because we have to talk about the negative. Even if 46% of American people oppose the health care bill, we talk about them. We don't talk about the 51% that supports it. That's the problem. That's the problem in American politics.
Why don't you shake that up, Donna?
I try every day. I try every day. I try to talk to, when I'm on TV, I try, when I look through those lenses, I'm thinking I'm talking to a family in Nebraska. Don't ask me why I picked Nebraska of all places. Maybe because I haven't been there in 5 years. But I try to talk to someone in Kansas or Missouri. I try to explain it. I try to give people the nuances of the bill without getting into the, you know, politics of it. In large part because I spent most of my adult life learning public policy, being a staffer on Capitol Hill, being a public servant. I care more about the American people than I care about the Democrats. I care more about my country than I care about my partisan affiliation. I just happen to be on TV playing a Democratic strategist when I'm not involved in Democratic campaigns whatsoever anymore. But that's the way you're positioned on the air, and therefore people assume that I'm speaking on behalf of the president. God forbid. Or the Democrats. Oh, no. I'm just trying to be an average person who works 4 part-time jobs on a small business that who lives in Washington, D.C., but travel all over the country. But I try to tell people what I believe based on the facts. And if they agree, fine. If you disagree, it's fine. We all have some gumbo and we can work it out.
You're way above average, Donna.
Well, I try to be, but my mother would always tell me to shut up when I was a little girl. God forbid. My mother never lived long enough, God bless her soul, to see that her daughter would even get paid to talk. But my mother used to say, Donna, you're a tape recorder. Shut up.
So she probably knew what was going to happen to you. You're a tape recorder. Oh, that's funny. Sarah, thanks for the call. Linda in Monroe. Hi, Linda.
Good morning, Kathleen. Good morning, Ms. Brazil. It's really a pleasure to talk to you. I'm really enjoying this. Now, we're presently borrowing money from communist China, so evidently our system is in trouble financially because of the lack of the federal regulations, which neither group, the banks or the stock market, like the regulations. So when I listen to the Republicans, they seem to hate socialism, which seems to regulate the banks and the insurance companies and the stock market. So my question is, how do we get the message out with news outlets like Fox News and former Governor Mike Huckabee reporting the news?
You know, you asked a very important question. In fact, Alan Greenspan recently, I believe he was on PBS, talked about the need to allow the tax cut to expire. And the bottom line is we're borrowing money. We're borrowing money from China to basically keep our own economy down, our own markets down. So that's one reason why we should have this debate over the tax cuts. I believe, is that we don't have the resources. Last night I was in my basement, and Kathleen, my basement is an American history museum.
Is it?
So, oh, God, I have an issue with clutter, but don't tell Oprah because I know she focuses with Nate Berkus on clutter and other issues, but I'm a clutter queen. But the reason why is because I think every piece of paper is special, and I have to go back and read it. So I was reading up on this period of time in the 2000 campaign when Al Gore and the administration put out a statement after the CBO forecast that we had a record surplus for 10 years. So right now, and 10 years later, we have a record deficit. But back 10 years ago, we had a surplus. And the administration was trying to figure out how to handle the surplus. And so Al Gore put out a statement that we would have modest tax cuts. But basically, everything that we would do, our focus would first be to pay down the national debt and then provide modest tax cuts. modest investment in the economy. We all know what happened. President Bush took office, and we had record tax cuts, record spending. And, of course, after 9/11, we and the invasion of Iraq a year later, we also began to accumulate even more debt. And then we passed a prescription bill, more debt. So the fact is that we need to get back to common sense, what I call common sense fiscal conservatism. My mother used to tell us we cannot buy what we don't have. We cannot spend what we won't get. So, I mean, I don't know, but for a woman who had 9 children,
oh my,
with a husband, our income was about $11,000 a year with 9 kids.
Oof.
And the way my parents made it was that we had to shop with coupons. We couldn't waste anything. We lived within our means. I mean, and my mother used to say, "You can't want what you don't have." I mean, and so we never had a desire. Like to this day. We don't have the, I look at my brothers and sisters. I mean, I still live in a house I bought back in 1992. Until a week ago, I was driving the same car I've had for the last 8 years. Someone ran a red light and wrecked little poor Esther, my car.
Oh,
but
Esther.
My parents taught us those values. What has happened to our country is that we now, this greed, this I got to have it, I got to be bigger, I got to be, you know, larger. People are living outside of their means, and not just people, our government. So we need to tighten our belts quickly, because right now China has so much money, they're going over the world, and they're buying up everything. And look at us. Look at the United States of America. We're sitting on mountains of debt. So we need to have a realistic conversation in this country about what it means to live within our means. That's it.
Yeah. Thanks so much for the call, Linda. Here's an email that's come in that takes the subject a little farther from Todd in Baraboo, who says he's always enjoyed your work, Donna, and your foresight for the country's future. Could you address this widening gap, and it is a huge gap, between the rich and poor that Todd feels is destroying our democracy?
Todd, I totally agree with you, and it's one of the conversations that in this task cut debate that we failed to have. And that is, over the last 30 years, there's been a decline in you know, money. We're working harder, but we're making less. And the middle class in this country has really suffered. Our incomes have stagnated. So the top 2% of income earners now take in about 40-50% of the wealth of the country.
Isn't that something?
And it's this inequality has been going on now for decades. And every time you get into these fights over the tax cuts, people are saying, "Well, what defines a rich person?" Well, as someone who grew up with working poor parents, anybody who made over $25,000 when I was a kid was rich. and God knows, if you had a car, you were super rich. But in today's economy, let's say we will find a figure that we can all agree on. The president defines it as $250,000. 98% of the American people make less than $500,000 a year. 98%. So we're focused on the top 2% and their tax cut. Meanwhile, 98%, I keep telling people, can we focus on their jobs and their incomes? No offense to the top 2%, but let us focus on 98%. Can we just focus on making sure that average Americans have jobs, health care, good quality of life? We know the American people are hardworking. We know the American people care about their families and their community. We know the American people are good-natured and good souls. You notice that every time there's a disaster, we're number one. We're always sending relief, whether it's in Haiti, whether it was recently in Pakistan, and, of course, down in the Gulf. But it's time that we focus on our own, focus on the American people, 98% of the American people, to ensure that our kids can inherit the quality of life that we have experienced growing up in this wonderful country. And that will take leadership. That will take electing politicians who don't demonize people simply because they disagree with them on policy issues. And I hope when we have this tax cuts debate, because we're going to have it, because the Bush tax cuts are set to expire. And I say from day one, first of all, let's stop talking about Bush tax cuts because they're going to expire. Let's talk about our tax needs in the future. And stop talking about what happened 8, 9, 10 years ago. But unfortunately, I don't run anything but my mouth, Kathleen.
Your mama was right. They should pay you to talk. You're good. Donna Brazil is our guest for all things political, and we're welcoming more phone calls for her. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Today was to have begun the beginning of our pledge drive, but we had a lot of people who came forward and made donations, so we had a day taken off, and that was today. And now we're only 140 pledges away from taking tomorrow off for our pledge drive because we have had 1,460 pledges. I urge you to, at this moment, go to WPR.org and make a pledge, or you can call 800-747-7444, 800-747-7444 for a pledge-free tomorrow. And that would be great. And then we can spend a full hour talking tomorrow. We'll be back with Donna Brazil in a moment on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Connie Kilmark with us the second hour of our program today. Connie is great. She's a financial counselor and consultant in private practice in Madison, and she's worked with all kinds of individuals and couples to improve communication about money and also your technical skill in managing. I must admit right up front that I am very bad at managing money, and I'm not very proud of that, but she teaches me information and will you as well. And it can be a huge source of great consternation if you're a college student and you have these huge student loans, if you are, have you been downsized, if you got furloughs, if you don't feel as though you're making as much money as you used to, and who is, if you're worried about your retirement and who isn't, Connie can give valuable information, and she will, along with a nice touch of psychology. So she's our number two. Donna Brazil is here now. Our number is 800-486-8655. Emily is calling from La Crosse. Hello, Emily.
Good morning.
Hi.
Good morning, Emily.
Good morning. I was just calling. I am a student organizer at UW La Crosse who is organizing students to get out the vote. We have the Tea Party of Wisconsin is doing some pretty strong disenfranchisement. Blah, 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 blah. They're trying to get targeting specifically students and minorities not to vote in the upcoming midterm election.
Wow.
And I was
what are they doing?
Experience.
What are they doing?
Well, they're targeting student and minority dense areas to battle registrations. There's more information available from One Wisconsin Now, who actually broke the story. But they're making some pretty intense efforts to contest registration of students and minorities. And I heard the mention of some experience working with student with young voters, and I was wondering if you could give me some advice as a student organizer. What is effective in getting young people out to vote?
Well, first of all, as you were talking, I'm sending a note to the Democratic National Committee and some of the nonprofit organizations that work with student organizations to ensure that you all have adequate resources to fight any attempt to disenfranchise student voters. Look, the most important thing is to sit down with young people and tell them what's at stake in this election. Since the election of President Obama, there's been a very strong increase in the investment in higher education. There's been resources poured to help community colleges, to help students who are going to college on Pell Grants, to help students who get their loans from who formerly got their loans from Sallie Mae and others. So this is an attempt to turn the clock back on those advances, on the increased investment in higher education. I think you need to let students know what's at stake in its election in terms of their commitment to the environment, their commitment to finding solutions on climate control, on health care, the things that young people care about. Talk about those issues and motivate them that if they want to continue to make progress. Now, we haven't done everything right in Washington, D.C., but we've made some advances on those issues. If they want to stay in the game, they got to vote. If they want to be future leaders in this country, they have to stay involved. And look, some of those young people need to prepare themselves for a lifetime of service in terms of running for public office at some point. So this is no time to sit it out. You all are responsible. Your generation are responsible for the changes that we've seen over the last 2 years in our electorate. More of you voted than ever before. We saw an increase in youth voter participation. There was a surge of young people. If you turn out, you turn the election. You can turn the tide against the Tea Party and their backwards movement. And once you get America moving on the right track, but you have to stay involved, Emily. You got to stay involved even if no one calls you. Make up your own slogans. Get young people excited. Let them know that their vote will make a difference in putting in Congress and clearly in the White House people who represent their values and who will listen to their voices and who will empower them to become the change that they're looking for in their lives in the future.
I'm going to put you on hold for a moment, too, because we'd like more information. If Chrissy can talk to you about this story that it escaped my attention, One Wisconsin Now, because nobody should be intimidated in trying to register to vote, be you whatever, Tea Party member or whatever. You just, that can't happen. This is America. So if you could let Chrissy know where that's coming from, we'll try and dig into that. Thank you, Emily, very much for your call. And here's an email that's come in, Donna, related to voting. Colleen on the road, please address the importance of college students requesting absentee ballots for November. There isn't enough education out there.
Well, as you know, in the Higher Education Act that passed on Capitol Hill, there's a provision that basically stipulates that colleges and universities must tell students of their right to apply for an absentee ballot. If you're on a college campus or if you have your kids and they did not register in the city or the town that they're currently living in while on campus, please make sure that they call up their hometown voter registration office to request the absentee ballot. Normally takes about 10 days for those ballots to come. You can request them online. You can call a toll-free number because many of these local election offices have toll-free numbers. But the bottom line is you got to call and get that information. Now, many of these states also have early voting, and if you have an opportunity to go home on a weekend, for example, some of y'all might be going home on Halloween weekend, we need to encourage young people to vote as well. But the most important thing is for the parents and grandparents to call up their youngsters. I text all of my nieces and nephews. I have several. And I remind them every election to go out and vote. I try to send them notifications 2-3 weeks out. Basically, I send Halloween cards. That's my way of telling them I expect you to vote. Otherwise, you will not get my world-famous gumbo when I come home for Thanksgiving. And Auntie Donna is not putting anything in the stocking. Yes, I do try to encourage them to vote. But we need to talk about the importance of this election. The reason why midterm elections are so difficult for Democrats and historically is that our electorate tend to be younger, tend to be minorities, people of color, and I often say, and they tend to be busy. So we need to encourage young people, people of color, and others to get out there and vote. We really need a sizable turnout this fall in order to make a difference. And the Tea Party, as I mentioned, they're energized, they're engaged, they're on a mission, and, you know, they're Americans, and so we have to engage them. We have to get into a very strenuous debate about the future of this country. But we also need to make sure that we use the tools that we have at our disposal to encourage people to get out and vote. And it's illegal to suppress, to intimidate,
yes, of
or
course
to arrest
it is.
Any
right.
eligible citizen from voting in the United States of America.
Yeah. George in La Pointe. Hi, George.
Hi, Ms. Brazil. I have great respect for what you've done.
Thank you,
many
George.
Of us voted for Barack Obama because of the hope that he would bring change. I think he needs to get out and acknowledge, one, those hopes have not been met, and two, take off the gloves and indict clearly and specifically those Republicans who stood in the way of not allowing those hopes to be met.
Well, George, you and I could be best friends and neighbors, because there are days when I sit back and I say, God, oh, my God, he is so wonderful. President Obama is very calm. He's rational. Yes, he's cerebral, but he's also passionate. And from time to time, you see it. I saw it when he was in Wisconsin at the rally. I saw it a few weeks ago when he was in Ohio. I think when you're in the White House and you're trying to govern a very polarized nation, the tendency is to reach out. The tendency is to try to find common ground. The tendency is to try to work with the other side. The problem is that the Republicans will sit in a room one day and say, okay, Mr. President, we'll meet you halfway. But when it's time, the crunch time, when it's time to make a decision, they pull away. And I don't know if you read some of the stories about Lindsey Graham, the senator from South Carolina, who was working with the president and the Democrats on the climate control bill. Well, the Republicans start mocking him. They start making fun of him. They start attacking him, demonizing him. They start saying, oh, have you talked to Rahm lately? And he retreated. So let me just tell you, George, in this political environment, it's very difficult to find Republicans who are willing to cross over the aisle to work with the president because their own caucus often shun them and will not allow them to make any progress in reaching out. So this president, in my judgment, has been a very good president. Overall, I've given him a B+. He hasn't made the grade as far as I'm concerned, but you know what? He stands to make an A for effort if he continues to reach out and he continues to inspire hope in others. One last thing, George, I want to say this. Change starts at the top, but it starts at the bottom. It starts with us. And a changing nation, a hopeful nation, requires that all its citizens are engaged, are involved. And we need to also inspire the president to do more and to get out there and to do the very best for all of us and not be intimidated by those who simply wish that he fails.
Thanks, George, for the call. Jim is next from Milwaukee. Hello, Jim.
Yes, I'd like to hope that Ms. Brazil will teach the public the concept of the self-fulfilling prophecy. In the self-fulfilling prophecy, you say bad things are going to happen. You create the circumstances for them to happen, and then you piously sit back and say, I told you so, and blame the opposition for making them happen. So, for example, in the job situation, the Republicans let the immigrants into the country, allowed them to be exploited, and then use them as a lever against American workers. They also obstruct, of course, any legislation the Democrats want to pass. And then in terms of the debt, they say, well, they predict that you're going to have a problem funding entitlements. Then they run up the tax breaks for the rich and involve us in needless wars. And then they say, well, we told you so, it was going to happen. But they created the situation in both instances.
That's why hope is the best antidote for our future as a country. Yeah, I see the cynical politics. I see it every day of my life. I see it not only when I'm on TV, but I see it, you know, when I'm out there trying to talk to citizens, when I'm teaching my students. And we're at a point now in our country's future where we're worried. We've lost confidence in each other. We've lost confidence in government. We've lost confidence in Wall Street. Pretty much we've lost confidence in ourselves. And it's time that we all get, like, you know, what I call a big dose of confidence so that we go out there and do our very best. We are the best people. We are hardworking people. I'm not saying best because that's not a bigoted statement, but I do believe in my country. I believe that when we come together, there's nothing we cannot solve, that nothing that we cannot do. As Americans, throughout our history, when people thought that we were down, we somehow found it in ourselves to get back up and to keep going. And I think about my own grandparents and my parents and how they got up every day. And despite the odds of living in a segregated deep South, they went out there and they worked and they came home and they fed their kids. We need to inspire hope in others. And we need to tell each other that, you know, despite all our problems, we will survive. And all these naysayers, these negative voices, we need to drown them out and just stop listening to them. I don't listen to them. When I see a tweet that I disagree with, I just keep moving. I look for one that I agree with. And sometimes I have to look from sources that I least expect. But at least I believe in the future of my country, and I'm going to continue to fight for America and what's good for our country and fellow citizens.
Donna Brazil, thank you so much for being with us this hour.
Well, thank you so much. I wish I could tell you all about my recipe last night. I cooked succotash with okra, corn, and butter beans.
Ooh.
I grew my own okra this year.
Ooh.
My neighbor had some corn, and I made succotash, and we watched the games last night. And I know Green Bay will be playing the Redskins, and I'm not going to tell you what team I'm rooting for, but God bless you all, and good luck, and please get out and vote this coming November 2nd.
Thanks, Donna. Donna Brazil, our guest this hour. We thank her for her enthusiasm. She is, of course, a political strategist, adjunct professor, author, syndicated columnist, television political commentator, vice chair of voter registration and participation at the Democratic National Committee, and she was the campaign manager for Al Gore. She was the first African-American woman to manage a presidential campaign. On Wednesday of this program, we don't have it confirmed, but we've reached out to Pat Buchanan, who is a charming fellow and is usually agreeable to doing radio programs with us, so he should be with us on Wednesday morning. And just a reminder, we're trying to take some days off this pledge drive, which I know you would love. We need not that many, about 140 more pledges to take off tomorrow, which would be wonderful. So if you want to pledge now, that'd be great. You go to WPR.org or you can go to 800-747-7444. Thanks to Chrissy Pease for producing this hour and to Chrissy as well for on-air production. We'll return following the news.